Episode 15 of the Cowcast, 2016 Retailer Wrap-Up, 2017 Outlook. I'm Eric.
I am James.
And we have a special guest.
I'm Chris.
Chris, of course, is the old owner of Cowabunga Comics. Or previous owner, because you're not really that old.
I was going to say, let's key
former older.
Key on the old part.
Yeah. So Chris was perfect, we thought, to weigh in with some insight into the things that we were going to talk about today, which kind of comes out of an article and several, I guess, different things that have taken place over the last several months, where a lot of people are becoming doomsayers about the comic market, specifically with regards to comic book stores closing. And there are a lot of people talking about big rounds of store closings in the first and second quarter of 2017. Also tying into this would be conventions that are getting shut down. It looks like 2017 is going to be kind of a do-or-die year for a lot of comic shows and pop culture shows. So we're going to kind of talk about our opinions and feelings going into this, and Chris is going to have some good insight for us. So let's start off with our first question. And I think the
first one I think we have is, what metric do you use to gauge the healthiness of the comic book market?
Well, let's turn it over to you, Chris.
That is an awesome one.
The only metric you can really use is sales, right?
What if the sales are Champions is selling, number one sold 350,000 copies, but 200,000 were through Loot Crate, and they had 1 in 500 variants that they sold 50 of to large accounts. I mean, so in that instance, sales are great if you sold 350,000 copies of Champions number one, but how does that translate to?
So are we talking comic book shop as in the local store or the whole industry?
I think more the comic market in general.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, again, it's a hard one. I guess you go back. So let's use relaunches then. I mean, how many relaunches do they have? I mean, ideally, the whole relaunch system and the variant cover system and everything is working to some extent because the comic book stores are there to make money. Right? Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if it wasn't working, they'd be finding something else. And they probably are looking for other things also. You always are anyway. So obviously that system of increasing sales in the short term with the relaunch or the death of, or, oh my gosh, Aquaman's little buddy is gay, or whatever it is that you're trying to do.
All new, all different, all this, all now.
Oh boy, yeah, kind of stuff. I think it's something that's actually working for them. But I have to also have to think that every time they relaunch, like Rebirth or 52 or whatever Marvel's doing all the time now, is admitting that the product isn't working. So now we have to scrap it, start over again.
Yeah, and I think that that's a slippery slope, because you say it's working or they wouldn't be doing it. Well, it's working for the home office.
Right.
It's not necessarily working for the local retail shop. I mean, there's a reason that we're seeing, even without the loot crates, without all of those types of things, there's a reason we're seeing, with Marvel books in particular, a huge drop-off from that first issue to the second, and then it's like a 60 or 65% drop between issues one and three.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a reason you're seeing that. It's because it's inflated through those variants, those, you know, tiered variant systems, and that doesn't help the retailer at all.
Part of it, though, too, is true. Like, you get, okay, we're going to have a new artist and writer on whatever X book or whatever book it is. And people are excited. All right, I like that artist. I like that writer. They can read the first two issues and they go, this one's really not working for me. And then they'll stop anyway. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, again, I think the other thing that I've noticed over the 10 years is that the relaunches are happening quicker and quicker and quicker.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, so Marvel's relaunched Silver Surfer 3 times in the last 3 years.
Well, Squirrel Girl had like 4 or 5 times.
It was, right. I think, 3 times in 2 years.
And Squirrel Girl doesn't bother me as much as like a bigger title, but I mean, they're sure. relaunching titles really, really quickly again.
Well, and the frustration with Silver Surfer is it's the same creative team. It's the same storyline. They just go back and renumber number one.
Right. I totally agree with that. That's, I think, was it you? I don't remember who said this. The thing about relaunches is that it's a great jumping on point for new people. That's the idea. The backside of that is it's a great jumping off point for people.
Yeah, we talked about that with Rebirth.
Yeah.
No matter how many reboots you do and renumberings and relaunches, it's eventually going to be through attrition. You're going to lose customers. You know, if you have a book that's got a very dedicated customer base, if you have people that have been buying whatever book it is for the last 20, if they've been buying X-Men since they bought the Jim Lee number one, and because you've diluted the name and you've diluted the brand so many times with, there have been, I think, 5 new Avengers series since 2002 or 3.
Yeah.
And so when people come in to look at the trades, which are not differentiated, they don't say New Avengers Volume 2, Volume 2. You know, they have brand delusion, I think, that's going on. We have a lot of people that will come in and look through books and say, I think I was reading, All New X-Men, but I'm not sure if I was reading this All New X-Men
or the
last one. And the other thing with brand dilution that Marvel's doing is everything has, so you have Extraordinary X-Men and Uncanny Inhumans and everybody's on different teams. The Thing is a member of the Guardians of the Galaxy and Wolverine is on every single team and Spider-Man's on a bunch of teams. And so at some point, it takes away from the importance of what the teams used to represent. What is the difference of being on Avengers or X-Men or Guardians of the Galaxy or Fantastic Four if everybody's on every team and they share the same Extraordinary or Uncanny or whatever you want to call the book?
I think that's left over from early Marvel, right, where they had one character. Then they said, hey, let's make a group and then we'll be able to sell 2 comics. And then it's like, well, then let's have one character visit this comic. And then we'll sell one more to that person for this month kind of thing. And maybe this is just like, I mean, we know it is. This is that theory on steroids or like cancerous would be a better way.
Yeah, maybe.
It's just growing and growing and it's just like, And there's something weird about the way whatever models the industry is using, they just sort of want to start multiplying and multiplying. I totally get it if you've got a hot book you want to spin off, a miniseries spin off or something. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're complete crap. But the fact that, you know, at some point you have 3 Thor books instead of just one, and you've got 3 Thor books with maybe 1.5 good stories. So why not just have one good Thor book that people actually want to read instead of, like, getting them to pick up 3 and going, well, this one's all right, but I'm really kind of...
Well, there's where Rebirth
is. Two of those Thor books in this case are Jason Aaron. Right, so why not just make that a double-sized issue or something like that?
Or save it for... Eventually he's going to have a bad month where he can't come up with something.
But let's talk about... You said 3 Thor books are too much, but if we know that 1 Thor book is all you need, and you're coming up with good material for 2 books, why don't they do what DC did, which is trim the fat, and put out their core titles and release them twice a month?
Now, I would rather... So, I think Rebirth was great. Because I think it recentered DC in their own universe. I think it brought them back to what made them great. Rebranded, rebooted, whatever, that can be a tricky thing. But the only flaw that I have with the twice a month is that it can almost get to be too fast. And then you get things like Monster Men.
Mm-hmm.
Where that was, by and large, I think is probably one of the bigger downer story arcs within the Rebirth main titles. That was the one that spanned for a month between Batman Detective and Nightwing.
And we know exactly why they did that, because they got it straight from the horse's mouth.
Right,
because
they weren't able to keep up with the writing. Now, maybe what you do is you go every 3 weeks. So some months you only get 1 book, some months you get 2.
Like Marvel did that.
Right.
2 years ago they would print that 13th book. Or...
And that, to me, that seems a little bit more of a reasonable pace. The other flip side on Rebirth that I think is cool, and I almost wish that some other storylines would be taking the same approach that are doing the twice monthly, is what Rucka's doing with Wonder Woman, or did. I think the year one stuff is done now with Nicola Scott, but the way that he had the two storylines going that were independent of one another because they were in different, completely different times, really allowed you to get double the story in that sense, because each month you were getting a piece of each timeline. Mm-hmm. So I think finding unique ways of doing that is good. I think that's healthy. If you're going to go to twice a monthly, give me something a little different.
That's true. So, but getting back to metrics.
Yeah.
So the twice monthly thing, I'm not a naysayer for the industry. I'm not a doomsayer for the industry. But that made me worry. That basically said to me, we need X amount of dollars off the Batman title. So we've been putting out this book and we're not getting it. So the only way for us to get it now is to double up the number of books we put out a month. Which would make me think that sales were shrinking enough so they felt they had to put some sort of thumb in the dike. Except this was way more than a thumb. They built another dike is what they did. I mean,
yeah.
So there,
I think they admitted that though. They admitted that going into Rebirth that the new 52 lost its way and became a failure. I mean, we heard, again, straight from the horse's mouth, we heard that from Dan DiDio, that they took the wrong path with the new 52. And
I'll add, if you haven't listened to that episode on our podcast, you can go back and we do have the raw audio of the DC Retailer Roadshow with Jim Lee and Dan DiDio talking about losing their way and why they're coming to Rebirth. So if you haven't, go back and check that out.
Yep. Well, back to Chris.
Okay. That was just my point, though, then. So, but if they realized it, so if it was really just a wayward product that was causing their sales drop, and, did Rebirth bring it back, or did doubling up issues just the short-term way of recouping lost income over the last year of 52?
Well, they had,
or,
but the other thing was that their line is half, well, at least when Rebirth first came out, their line was half what it had been.
Yeah.
So they had... So half as many books, but yes, they were doubling down and...
So they were publishing the same amount of books then. They were just doing, they just...
Issues, right. Same amount of issues, less titles.
Right. Okay.
And I think one of the other key points that they had made was part of the Rebirth and the way that they started the publishing with the Twice Monthly was getting a tighter grasp on what was being written mm-hmm. and the difference. So in Gotham, you know, things like that where... In New 52, you'd have two sets of creative teams working on similar type stories like Batman and Detective. But they diverged so far in what Batman was doing in each one that readers were kind of left in a lurch. And so what they've done now mm-hmm. is they tried to bring that back together and make sure that they're telling the stories in tandem or, in the case of certain titles, just doing it all in one.
I think, but, so going back to DC doubling down on even though if you're a fan of a character, you'd love for that character to get a book. But if comic stores themselves aren't healthy, you're not going to get your books, right? I mean, if the market crashes.
Well,
so I
and
think
the other thing
Marvel,
too, like if you're a Black Panther or a Moon Knight fan, and you really love those characters, but your comic book store is not supported or not doing well because of sales or whatever, then it's likely that they're not going to carry the smaller books anyway. Mm-hmm. They might carry the big guns and special art or the stuff for people. So, did I just sort of make a point that you were making?
I think the biggest issue that, and not to harp on Marvel, but I'm going to harp on Marvel. So I would say Black Panther and Moon Knight are actually good titles. I mean, we have like 10 subscribers for Moon Knight, which for us, for a book like Moon Knight, is pretty good. I mean, Moon Knight we have more subscribers for than both Black Panther titles put together. Which isn't saying much, but, I think the biggest issue that Marvel has is we talk about short-term blasting customers, and they take properties, and so I don't even mean stuff like when they relaunched Starbrand and Nightmask that no one had been asking for. They had, for a period of time, you had Squadron Supreme, you had, is it Nighthawk?
Nightcrawler was in there.
Nighthawk and Hyperion. So you had three Squadron Supreme ongoing series running at the same time, for a title that has a hard time supporting one series.
But they've had success with that title before, so that might have been what they were trying to recreate.
Well, they had success with it with the J. Michael Straczynski run. But even that kind of petered out at the end. So why they thought they could put three Squadron Supreme... That's the thing
again,
Go ahead.
Did they all come out at once, or did Squadron Supreme start, and then the other two trickled in?
Yeah, well, that's what happened. I think it was Squadron Supreme... And then Hyperion, and then Nighthawk.
And that might have been planned, but I always wonder, especially with Marvel, if they start a book, Squadron Supreme, mm-hmm. we want it to sell X number of copies. Bang, 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 first three do fine. trickle, trickle, trickle as people lose interest or whatever. And then in order to maintain that X dollar amount from that title line, they spin off. So now they get maybe 10% of that loss back and then spin off another book, get 10% of that loss back. So, and then at some point the whole thing falls apart and they just cancel it and start over something else.
No, that's very possible.
Yeah. But I have no idea, but that's the only thing that ever made sense to me some of this stuff.
But again, why even,
or maybe they react too fast. Maybe fast.
It could be that.
Maybe this, oh my God, this is selling like hotcakes. Let's get some other stuff on the,
and I know people say like, yeah. I know people like, there's plenty of Squadron Supreme fans, but that's my question is what made Marvel think now is the time for us to blast Squadron Supreme? Like, and the money was out there to do that and not, for instance, to take, I don't know, what's a secondary character? I mean, I think if they wanted to do that short term, I bet Moon Knight could support two books for a little while and then it would crash down. But why Squadron Supreme? Why do they put these books out that everyone knows that they're dead on arrival when they
do
hit
they
the
have
solicits?
To do, so I remember something like with the early DC characters, they had to reuse the characters every year or something to maintain the copyrights. But DC's situation might have been different because they bought a ton of stuff from like EC and all the other places. Yeah. Marvels it's all their own characters,
but
so that wouldn't make
Squadron,
sense.
I mean, Squadron Supreme is a, but then if that's the do they have to have their own core book? I mean, because they could just throw Hyperion in Avengers for an issue, you know? I mean, I don't know. I guess I'm at the legal side of
they
it.
They did throw Hyperion in Avengers. He was great, but he didn't do anything.
Oh.
So from a metric standpoint, we talked about sales being the chief metric, right? And that's new comic sales in the stores. But there's got to be some other metrics that we can look at out there. Now, obviously, a metric that we track here at the shop are things like our pull list and how many books we're ordering on our pull list. Now, there's different influences on that. You know, if a local competitor goes out of business and you get some of their subscribers, but seeing a growth in pull lists of your subscribers over time is an indication that things are strong, whereas a decline can be that it's weak.
But that's not actually true, because you can get people that come in who have been out of comics for a while that buy a ton and then realize, oh, that's why I got out of comics.
Oh, yeah.
I can't. Yeah. And then you're left with the pull box full of stuff.
Or and those are the people that come in and they're very enthusiastic. Like, I want to add this and this and this, and they give you 19 titles, and then you never see them again. Because they get home and they read that stuff they bought the day they set the pull list stuff.
So I think it would be easy to misread. I mean, over time you could read maybe pull lists correctly, but in the short term you could misread.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely a long-term thing where you're tracking the subscribers you've had for years, not months.
Right. Yeah, we've definitely had a couple of those. More than a couple. We've had a good amount of those stars that, you know, they burned out a little too fast for us.
But it's worth trying, right? You gotta. What if they don't burn out? Then you're like, all right, this is awesome.
Right. And then, so you mentioned, and this is kind of back to the topic at hand, a store closing in the area. So we had, in our general area, we had several stores closed, but to different reasons. One of them was due to the death of the owner. Of course, Collector's Edge consolidated a location. They had four, and they got rid of one. And I don't know if they're going to do more. The rumor is that they might close another one, but we don't know. And then Neptune in Waukesha closed. And we don't know what's 2017 going to bring, you know, around here.
But at the same time, Planet Chaos has been around.
They've been around for a while.
5 years? Seven
no,
years.
Longer than that. I think they've been around for at least, I think they said 10. We were just
close
up
to
there.
10, yeah.
10 years, I think.
Wow. And the new place in Beaver Dam, is that?
I haven't been there.
Yeah, that's a hike.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, the thing is, 2 years ago when I sold the store, there were a bunch of closings the summer before that. Like, there's some big ones in Arizona that closed down that have been there forever that just shut their doors.
Well, it's weird because Arizona just had a bunch. They just announced there's like 9 or 10 comic stores closing this year in Arizona. One of them's a chain, I think, of 4 or 5 stores, but the other ones are just like individual stores that are all closing.
And there are some in California. There are a bunch of places that were closing down. I just wonder if, like, you know, like me, when it was time to sell, I'm just like, eh.
Yeah.
It's kind of a hard job to do. I'm tired of it. I'm closing it. But then new people come in to fill that void, or an existing store expands because of it. So I don't know that you could even call store closings. I mean, it might just be that the store market is saturated, right? There's too many stores, not enough customers. Mm-hmm. A couple of those fall out, then there's enough customers to support.
Well, the early 90s we had, I think at the height of it, was it 7,800 stores or something like that?
Yeah.
And after the crash, it went down to, was it under 2,000? Did it get under 2,000?
I don't know. I don't. That sounds really low to me, though.
Well, it went low. It did go low. Whatever the actual number was, we get a lot of people comparing what's going on right now to the 90s. As far as we talked about variants and people ordering, we just had somebody yesterday who, and we're gonna do it. He wants the 1-in-100 Alex Ross black and white variant of the new Iron Fist number one. Well, that's not a book we would normally order a ton of copies of, so we're going to have to charge him pretty much the difference that it's going to take to order that book, which is fine. But the drop in numbers between us ordering Iron Fist number one and Iron Fist number two is going to be
dramatic,
unbelievably dramatic.
Well, and what does that do to publishers too, right? So now they've got all these people, and there's got to be more than that one guy.
And but you got to think they know that if you have an Alex Ross sketch cover variant, that people are going to be ordering that book just to get that cover.
Right.
And that goes back to what you were saying with saturate the market and get those number one sales while you can. And then when Iron Fist starts to tank, they'll relaunch it again with infamous Iron Fist.
Uncanny, where Luke immortal Cage takes, Isle Fist.
Yeah.
Iron Fist.
Who knows? And they'll have another Alex Ross 1-in-200 black and white and get the numbers way up on that. And, I think that that is one of the reasons I like a lot what Image has been doing. And not,
well, then,
this
if that's the case, why do they have them be 1-in-100 variants? Why don't they just say, we are going to print 5,000 of these Alex Ross things? If you want them, they're going to be $150 each. Let your local comic book store know. There might only be one for every...
But then they're not incentive variants anymore. And that's the whole point is making it an incentive.
There's a buy-in incentive instead of a...
If the publisher is making an extra $150 because you're ordering 100 copies or whatever, then what do they care if it would be better for them because now they don't have to print an extra 100
copies
of the book.
It's worse in their eyes because they want you to have those extra books sitting on the shelf so that your shelves are flooded with their titles when people come in. And those Marvel books, because you've got a ton of them, are all that people see on the shelves, and they push DC.
They're displacing other books.
They're pushing other titles.
Yeah, but any good store,
we're not
going
to
do that.
We wouldn't do that, but there are stores.
And the other problem with that is, which books do you grab? It's like, do you grab the one that there's 50 copies of, or are you going to grab the one that there's one or two left? And oh my god, I might not be able to get a copy.
Yeah, there's that. Well, here's a good example: 25-cent books. They just did it with Red Sonja. Mm-hmm. Dynamite did.
Walking Dead's coming up.
I love 25-cent books.
They're doing it with the first issue of Vampirella. Now, each one of those is going to have the Red Sonja had a J. Scott Campbell 1-in-50 and 1-in-100 variant, and the Vampirella is going to have a Joe Linzer and J. Scott Campbell variant. I think those 25-cent books are fine. They cost, I think, less than what the Free Comic Book Day comics cost.
Well, because they're only like 20 pages or something, right? Are they smaller?
They're smaller, but it's like 13 cents or something for an issue, and... You're not going to be giving Walking Dead's, of course, got the 25-cent issue coming up. You're not going to be giving Walking Dead out to kids on Free Comic Book Day, but you can have a kids section and an adult section or something, and you can hand out a ton of copies of, if you plan something like that intelligently, you don't have to have them flooding your shelves. We have a humongous amount of those Red Sonjas left over because somebody wanted that 1-in-100 variant. And they bought it, and it paid for
everything. All
of those. And
I think going back to when I was a kid in the 70s at Capital City in Madison, what kept you buying was the scarcity of the product, right? That was the only store anywhere, as far as I knew, maybe in the whole world. And so I'd go in there. If there was one copy left, I had to have it right there.
Right. And the back market was taking off in the 70s, too. So you didn't want to have that book end up being that book you missed out on.
3 months... like X-Men 113. Yeah, those.
Yeah.
Daredevil 129. Those were killers. Yeah. So again, I don't see any benefit to flooding a market for a company, except that they're making cash on the front end, which if they could do it by just selling. And again, here's my thing with variants. I love variants for a comic book store. Okay. Cause we buy them for cheap. We can sell them for a lot of money. Sorry guys. It's just the way it is. Most of them are not going to be worth anything. Mm-hmm. And I feel bad selling them, but if you want them because you love the artist, I think it's fine. And you have the set or whatever. And your customer can actually afford it, and it's not going to put them in the poorhouse. But I mean, those things are cool, and if they could keep on supplying those to us,
how is it different when you go through when we're putting our order in? We're in Comic Suite, and we're putting our order in for Marvel books for 2 months from now, and you get to a title like Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur, which a well written book. We've got a couple subscribers. But let's be honest, it's not a book that screams longevity. It's not going to be around forever.
Yeah, they're not A-list characters that are in the common discussion of any comic book.
Right.
Reader.
So my question is, when you're putting your order in and you get to Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur issue 14, and there are 9 variant covers for it. There's the Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur, What the Duck variant, Hip Hop variant, Connecting Cover variant, the 1 in 15 variant, the 1 in 25 variant, the 1 in 200 variant or whatever.
And then there's the one where if you exceed 125% of your orders for Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur,
it's order all you want.
It's get all you want.
You get the Joe Jusko corner box variant. Is that any different than just pumping out chromium and hologram covers
in
the 90s?
No, it's the exact same thing. But here's the thing. If you've got people who want the hip hop covers, you can have one here. If you've got no one looking at the hip-hop cover, you don't even look at those issues. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, again, even though they're variants and there's fewer of them, I'm pretty sure they're printing more than enough to get everybody on the front end as many as they want. Because they want to make their money on the front end, right? They're not going to make any money off us reselling them on the back end because, you know, a hip-hop variant went viral or whatever.
But again, talking about the healthiness of the comic market, I guess if you're coming in to buy comics and you are looking for a random book, you've never bought comics before, you haven't bought comics in a long time, and there are 9 variant covers of a book that you're looking to pick up of the same issue. Let's say 5 variant covers.
And you pick up 5 of them thinking they're different issues.
Right. We've had plenty of people who've done that. A lot of them have done it with Rebirth, where they've come in and they've bought off the new rack, they've grabbed both issues of Suicide Squad. Well, both issues are the variant covers. And usually, you know, if it's somebody new, you try to catch it, but you're not going to call everybody buying variant covers, and you're not going to go, do you intend to buy this? It would be like all the people at Best Buy saying, you are aware that these black bars on the top and bottom of the screen are supposed to be there, right? I mean, we're not going to be able to do that. We're not going to catch everybody. And is that something that is going to long-term put people off? Because if somebody just wants to be a comic book reader, but you are forcing them to be part of a collector market. Is that a problem?
No, because you're not forcing anyone to be part of the collector's market. I don't think they are. I mean, I don't do variant covers.
How about forcing them to interact with it?
Again, they don't have to buy it. They don't have to feel obligated to buy it. You just buy, if you just want to read it, just buy the regular cover or whatever cover's out there. Who cares?
But if you're just average Joe Schmo looking at it, you don't think that that's going to cause any confusion that could have...
No, I think... Okay. Maybe yes, but if they're actually really interested in it and then there's some sort of learning curve where they're learning to understand the industry, like, oh, these are variant covers. It's the same book with a different cover. That's kind of cool for a new guy, don't you think? It's like, wow, I'm learning this stuff. I've got this insider knowledge of what's going on.
And I'm just playing devil's advocate.
I know how to avoid
here.
It. I don't think that's a problem. I don't think,
we love the collector's market. We love it. We're just playing devil's advocate,
right.
But it is a common complaint that I hear. And I see a lot of times online where people saying that variant covers are putting new customers off from getting into the game.
I think part of the problem is it's certain variant covers do that, certain ways of doing it. So the way that DC is doing it with open-to-order variants, I don't think puts people off as much as Marvel with their tiered ones, where as retailers, if you want to get that variant in many cases you need to charge more than cover price for it. Because you've got to cover the cost of the other issues you got. Like you were talking about the Iron Fist. And I think that's what puts people off when they say, well, why the heck does this one cost more?
Why do I have to pay $5 for that cool cover?
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I
think that puts
days.
People off. Mm-hmm. But honestly, like, I'm sorry. Jenny Frison, Wonder Woman covers?
Red Sonja covers?
Those are gorgeous.
Thanks, Jenny.
And they, yeah, thank you, Jenny. And they are open order.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so when you, as a customer, you're not out any different amount of cash for choosing the cover you want that looks the best to you, I think that's a bonus. But when you have to pay more,
or
that's detractive.
You've only got the variants left of a hot book, and then they have to pay more for the variant. That kind of stuff. The other covers that drove me crazy were ships with two covers. So, do you still have
your,
those?
Your A, B, C.
A, B cover, A, B cover.
Where you just randomly get what you want.
Is Spawn did that.
Didn't Spawn do that for a while?
Oh, probably. A lot of people did it for a while.
So you just put in your order, and then it gives they give you whatever.
Yeah.
Well, they usually come, you know, 50-50. Mm-hmm. But you always get stuck with that one extra or whatever, and then someone wanted the other one, and... Or everybody wants one of them, and then you've got six of the
other
one. The
big boom Power Rangers relaunch was like that. You couldn't order
which
Ranger
colors.
Cover you wanted.
Right, they just sent them.
Yeah, and so we had everybody call. I mean, we probably, that day they came out, we probably had, I'm dead serious, more calls about that book than we've ever gotten before or since about any book with people looking for specific Ranger covers.
Ranger.
And of course, they wanted the ones, they wanted
the
ones we didn't.
One of the rares.
We didn't get. And
I wonder, again, so... And again, I don't know if this is true, but I always felt that sometimes when covers got, not allocated, but shuffled kind of thing, mm-hmm. like we would get certain covers here and West Coast would get certain covers, which is fine because then you could sell them online back and forth kind of thing. But then people would come here looking for the Green Power Ranger, but no, we didn't get any. They're all in California and New York for some reason. So, but we got like Blue Power Ranger and Pink Power Ranger, which everyone in New York was looking for.
All right. Now here's, I think a question in,
Are we going off script?
It's a little bit off script, okay. But I just wonder if...
Because the script has been followed strictly.
Yeah.
Well, we with regards to stores, do you think that there's a certain amount of, if you need healthiness in the market, that there's a certain amount of collaboration between stores that should happen? Or do you think that... I mean, we've had a couple of stores that we've talked to and we have said, look, if you guys are short on a book or you have a new subscriber, just call us, you know, and we'll help you out if we can. And we've never heard from them.
Yeah.
Never,
so
ever. And
we tried that with area stores. I won't necessarily say who. We've tried that before. Part of the problem, though, is one, you have to get the books there. That's the biggest thing. Even if it's just driving to the next town over, so you have to find somewhere in your day to get those books there. The other issue is you're doing it with, we talked to my old store in Massachusetts and Neil's old store in St. Louis. If they need the books, yeah, but you still got to stick them in an envelope and get them there. So now you're sending like $3 books through priority mail. You're not, it would be a service. It wouldn't be making money for you kind of thing. Does that make sense?
Right. I suppose. I guess if you're talking about like a local store though, you know, if there's somebody who's, there's three books or some issue that they really need and then they're going to get into the, then they're going to subscribe to this book if they can get this issue or whatever. We've had plenty of things where we've had people subscribe to Marvel book on issue 3, but of course 1 and 2 are not, they're no longer in stock at Diamond. So
that'd be me.
You know, if you can, that's the question is, should stores
for the
betterment
of the industry?
Right. Does that help the industry? But like I said, we've offered that to a couple area stores and we have never heard word one from them, but we have heard from people that work at those stores about people getting angry that they're out of a book that we've had plenty of copies of on the shelf. So now conversely though, we've never called a store to see if they've had certain issues, but we've never had really been offered that either.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
I mean, it'd be cool if there was like an online thing with just the local area stores where you could say, hey, I've got extra of X. I know it's hot. Not here, but they're here if you guys need them. Or inversely, they can say, oh, my God, I'm looking for Moon Knight number 2. We don't care what cover.
Right.
I mean, yeah, that would be totally cool.
Mm-hmm.
But does that problem solve itself anyway? Like if someone came, not here because you would have everything, but if someone went to a competitor's store and they didn't have it, and they go, rah, 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 and then they just stomp out, and next time they're swinging by here, they come in and they find it. So does the customer solve that problem anyway, because he's going to go to another store to try to find it. Or online.
Well, I don't know, because when one of the local stores around here closed, I would say at least half of the people that
became subscribers here had never even been in here before. And we were not, I mean, what is it, 30 minutes, 25, if you're a Leadfoot away, and they had just never, ever come out to another comic store. And I think that kind of leads into another issue where you have, going back to the early 90s comparison, where you have stores that are set up to handle a down month or down quarter, and you have stores that aren't. And if you are primarily a store that is rocking and rolling on new comics, how many stores did we hear talking about that were on the brink of closing after Convergence and after the Secret Wars month? I mean, you look at, and I know that some stores did. Are we back to kind of reflecting that 90s model where these stores are so paycheck to paycheck that if you have DC crap in the bed and Marvel crap in the bed for 2 or 3 months, are these stores going to be just shutting down because nobody's buying books?
Well, is that, all right, here's the capitalism. Is that a bad thing? If the store is poorly run enough so that it can't support even a month's shortness, or didn't set capital aside in the beginning to cover those months, do we really care if they stay in business? If they haven't diversified their product line, which only makes sense, and if they're, I don't know, if they're doing it as a hobby kind of thing instead of, with no, we're just running a store here, we have no grand scheme or business plan. I mean, does it, again, if those customers are still going to come and find the store that's well run, is that a horrible thing?
No, I think it's.
And is that indicative of the industry, or is that indicative of poor management of the store?
Well, I think it runs a fine line.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, obviously the business person in the three of us is going to say, well, if you're not smart enough to run your store on a close enough margin to diversify, to plan for those down months or quarters, well, then you don't deserve to be in business. But at the same time, if that's the only store in the area and it goes out of business, now you've potentially turned off individuals to the entire market of comics. Because honestly, when people leave comics, they don't just leave for a month or 2 months. They leave for a decade or their life. And so,
and I read something that said if a comic book store closes, that something like 20% of the people that had pull lists just stop. This is sort of just a generalized number.
Even if they've got another comic book store nearby.
Right, they just stopped getting books. So you take those people out of the market. But to your point, if you have a small town and there are, let's say that the next closest comic store is 2 hours away, but it is kind of the neighborhood hangout. Yeah, you're right. You're kind of, it's the customers and the people that live there that are punished for it. But at the same time, it's not a right to have a comic book store. So,
right. But my feeling also is that, so there's a tiny comic book store up in Ellsworth, Maine. I've been there tons of times because we vacation up there with our family.
Maine has a lot of very good comic book stores.
And it's been there forever. And you walk in this place, and there's no offense, I don't know if you're listening, it's not particularly well run as far as I can tell. Seat of the Pants bought way too much of Death of Superman kind of place. And still probably has them under his tables and bins. But it's the only thing around, and it's still in business after all these years. So I think those isolated smaller stores are probably going to be okay. But Waukesha insulated. County, I think, was fairly saturated for market.
Oh,
and Milwaukee is the same
Milwaukee.
Way.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I think maybe it's in the bigger cities that you're going to get or the more dense areas that are going to see the contractions, where there are going to be other areas close by to get to.
So is part of the, some of the stores that have closed, not do a lot with back issues. Some of them just don't do anything with back issues. Is it necessary for the long-term survival of a comic shop to sell back issues? And I don't just mean having like stuff from a year and a half ago, but having like the stuff that we've got on the wall. Like, is that something that you think is necessary to the continued longevity of a comic book store?
Well, yeah, I think it's a collector's market, right? So you want to have collectibles that are cool. But any kind of diversity is good. Mm-hmm. Your games are good. Here's the plug. The action figures are good. The little knickknacks are good.
Aww.
We
have
the
lots
records,
of
the
games
video
workshop.
Games, the supplies, the boxes and the, and the boards are good. I mean, all that stuff is totally necessary, even right down to you having your soda in your candy bars for people to buy. You know, at some point, our soda and candy was like paying for all of our electricity for the whole month, and that was great. So, but even just small things like that, I think you have to do it. You couldn't just open a shop and sell like underwear because it wouldn't stay in business, right?
Well, but that, so that leads to the question that talking to some of the people that are at those stores, they don't, when we ask them, why don't you do back issues? The main feedback we get from them is that they don't really know the market, and it's
takes too much energy,
and it takes too much energy and effort to get into, to develop the knowledge to buy collections, to price them, to sell them,
to sort them,
and all you have. Whereas there's plenty of money to be made putting your diamond order in, pulling the sub books, and putting new books on the shelf, and ordering trades. And so, is that? I mean, are they right? Where that's a whole other. Where that's something that you have to learn an entirely new skill set, knowledge base for?
You do, but...
But that's how you evolve. That's how companies grow.
Or wouldn't you hope you were already sort of have that as a comic book store owner because you got into it? No one gets into this because it's a great business to get rich at.
But let's be honest. So I got into it because before we were in this store, I was selling at shows for... I mean, since my uncle was taking me to shows since I was five.
Right.
And so I mean, I know the comic back issue market very well and how to sell, and I can go through a collection pretty well. But at the same time, I know people that are, I know plenty of other people that sell at shows that they sell the same stuff that I sell, but I don't know if they could transition that over to a store, you know, and.
Meaning they don't have the back issue knowledge, or they don't have the.
I just don't think it's the total management package that you need, because there's more than just knowing a product line. You have to know the product. I mean, there's a lot of things that...
Well, and your product line and needs change all the freaking time.
And the way that you interact with your customers has to constantly evolve. And the way that you market yourself has to change. I mean, we talk about what's our 2017 plan. We've got some marketing adjustments that we want to make. You know, social media interaction, that changes monthly.
Well, and 6 months ago, if you had told me that our Games Workshop sales would destroy and start doubling our Magic sales, I would have said, you're crazy, but, you know, you can't predict that kind of thing.
Right.
So it's...
But you have to recognize it, see it.
Oh, for sure.
And play to that strength. You can't just stock the same old stuff and go, gosh, boy, that sells good. Better get another one of those. You have to understand and grow that.
So at the end of the day, if you have 5 or 6 people a month, Eric and I just did a comic shop crawl. And we had a bunch of stores, 9 or 10 stores, in a day, and we would go into stores and we'd look around and we would ask some of the people behind the counter, where do you keep your high dollar keys? And half of them didn't even know what we were talking about.
This I'm not even telling keys. You where we keep our keys.
Yeah.
In my pocket.
Forget it. And well, we actually had one guy who like looked down at his keys and he's like, my keys? They said, no, your high dollar books. Where do you keep? And I wonder if that's just something where if you do have that down month, you, like you said, you got to diversify. But these stores that kind of run themselves like a Barnes & Noble, where they're primarily trades and primarily new books, I think if you are Midtown or you're, one of Barger's stores, or I mean, there's plenty of people who can totally make it happen and do it very well. Larry's Comics. But if you're just in it to put comics on the shelf and, you know, you're not trying to maximize that, I don't know. I wonder if that's, like Chris said, maybe it's not necessarily a terrible thing if you get a humongous amount of those stores kind of weeded out and then replaced with somebody who does. I wonder if talk about the Kickstarter thing.
Our Kickstarter thing or just any Kickstarter?
Well, we can talk about that quick, but there's a lot of stores now, and this is like it's on Bleeding Cool and stuff like that where they, some store, all of a sudden, they had a bad couple of months, and they're doing a GoFundMe, you know, and they need $40,000 to stick around. And I'm sure that a lot of these stores have been part of the community for decades or however long. And that's great, but do we need to let those stores take the inevitable final step and let something else replace them if it's going to be there? Are the GoFundMes and Kickstarts for businesses, is that just kind of counterproductive in the long run? Are we just trying to hold back the inevitable?
Maybe, but at least they're thinking outside of the box, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're thinking beyond like dollar sidewalk sale or something. Then maybe they're trying, and maybe it was something short term, maybe it was something longer term. Hey, the problem was maybe it is a longer term problem. They're not even aware of it. Like maybe they think this is a short term problem and fixing the finances now will be good. And then things will get better down the way. But if things don't get better,
right,
then you're still back at square one. So having spent $40,000 more.
It's that, what led you to that point? Were you buying a glut of books that sit on the shelf? I mean, we've talked about it on our podcast multiple times where we order tight. I mean, we get titles that we know are going to sell. Mm-hmm. We may reach for a couple, but we don't put 20 of them out on the new bookshelf. We put three. You know, we're very calculated with what we're doing. We sell what we know. We sell what we are comfortable providing to someone, even if we don't know it. And that's where the line is drawn. We can't go and order
everything
in the back half of previews. Hell, we don't even order half of what Marvel puts out some months because there was, I think, I was just listening to John Mayo's, I think it was December numbers for his comics, Top 300. And I want to say that Marvel had 103 regular issues or like something like that. And then they had 116 variants. You're selling more variants than you are mainline titles, right? And that's, we're not going to stock all of that. That's garbage. That's waste. That's extra expense. Well, no, there's a lot of stores
you're looking at two different things, right? Because their needs as a publisher are totally different than your needs as.
Right.
I mean, you need each other and you need to work together.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure.
Well, but, you know, if they can sell two copies of a number one using a variant, that's better for them. But that doesn't mean. But again, here's the kicker, right? Because there's no return policies on most of this crap.
Mm-hmm.
If you could return this stuff, I bet you they would switch their gears really
quick.
Would
an answer be having, and I don't think anybody's really going to like this except for the retailers, but do it like Barnes & Noble does where you have a higher cost on the book. If you go to the Barnes & Noble, their DC books are going to be a dollar higher, but they're returnable. So is it worth charging, you know, and a $3.99 Marvel book is going to be $4.99.
I think the problem with that is I think $3.99 is already pushing a limit are comfortable with.
I think that
that's why what's good for the goose is not good for the gander in this instance. Right. I mean, if we're going to order more books if they're returnable, that's going to be good for the customer, but they're going to buy less books because the books cost more. So,
right. But you'd be making more.
Unless you do something like what DC did with Rebirth, where you make the first couple of months. You know, that hump from the first issue to the third issue where that drop-off happens, you make that returnable. So you've incentivized the store. Now, yes, for all of you out there who go, wait a minute, aren't you giving a free loan to DC by buying extra books? Yes, but what you do is you give the shop a chance to pump the product a little bit more, try and catch the purchasers, and then if it doesn't sell, you as the company are basically, like DC, when we were at the roadshow, is basically saying, we're confident in our product that it's going to sell better for you than what New 52 did. To do that, we're going to allow you to buy more so that you can send it back if it doesn't.
And here's a great example of us doing store crawls and things where we get a lot of information to help us kind of figure out what the market's doing. We ordered, 30 or 40 copies of Aquaman Rebirth number one, of a book that we had normally sold maybe one copy of a month if we were lucky. And we sold through 35 copies or something like that. Ridiculous. So we talked to somebody at another store, kind of in this general area, who said, well, he normally sold, two copies of Aquaman, so he got four.
Four, doubled.
Of a fully returnable book, and they were all gone, like, within an hour of opening that Wednesday. So is that an instance where he ordered two more copies of what should, I mean, you should order higher on a relaunch anyways, but being fully returnable didn't impact his store a whit. It didn't matter. So
I don't know what store it was. Do you tell them you're owners of a store when you go in and talk to them about
Depends.
The numbers and stuff?
Usually. Most of the time.
Yeah. Okay. Not that it really matters.
There have been one or two times where we've been to stores where they were exceptionally rude right away, so we're just like, we won't even get into it.
Yep.
We'll just be secretive about it. That might have been a case where I would love to order, you know, to pay thousands of dollars up front to have my shelves flush with goodies.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe it wasn't their pockets weren't deep enough to pull that all in. Especially for Aquaman. I mean, maybe they chunked up on Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. And then the rest of them, they're like, we'll do the best we can.
Yeah, could be.
So,
but I think, I'm thinking from a stance of, you know, Marvel is trying to sell to the customer. Marvel's also trying to sell to the retailer with all their incentives and their varying crap that they do. DC wants to partner with the retailer and sell. Valiant wants to partner with the retailer and sell. There's companies out there that take a different approach. And while I think that overall returnability is maybe not the best thing for the market because you get false numbers, false money.
But I
think that the way that DC did it to give you those first few months to get through that hump.
Right.
Is basically, they're saying our product's good enough to sell.
Right.
And that to me is a better indication of strength or at least perceived strength by the publisher.
And there's two things there. One, too. I think Marvel and DC are probably more resilient to market fluctuations than the small local store, even a large store.
Oh,
right?
Sure.
So it's kind of unfair that they dump a lot of the risk
on the retailer.
But how much of how Marvel, let's just call Marvel the bad guy right now in terms of, because their practices are the most...
They can be frustrating as a retailer.
The most frustrating, thank you. How much of that is because the retailers are buying into what they're doing? So they're going ahead and they're buying 50 copies to get variants of stuff. And so the retailer's doing all this stuff. But if they stopped, if all that sort of dried up, would Marvel then say, well, we'll just give you the first returnable, the first two issues will be returnable. You can keep the variants because they're going to sell, that kind of thing. Like they did with, was that Valiant? I think Valiant did it when they first came out again. They said you could return stuff, but you get to keep all the variants you got because of what you ordered.
Hmm.
And that was totally awesome. Thank you, Valiant.
Is that when Neil was ordering like the 1 in 500s and stuff?
Yeah, or whatever they were. Yeah, 1 in 200s. They were a lot of them. Was totally awesome because you got to keep the high value books and return everything else.
Yep. Well, it's just like anything else though. And you mentioned not having the upfront capital to order 40 copies of Aquaman. You do have to have money to make money, you know, and there's no doubt about it. And if you, but that comes down to making more sound decisions. Like if you are a store that is going to just order, if you order 4 copies of Aquaman, your margin is absolutely fixed. You cannot make more than.
Right. And we were guilty of that in the last 2 years before we sold to you guys. I mean, we were ordering very, very spare at that point.
But you kind of had, at that point, you were
kind of
divested.
I was ramping down, yeah, there's no doubt about it. But I mean, I totally remember making that, those mistakes. I mean, they weren't returnable.
Sure.
But it was still a mistake to just order two, or, you know, to double your order kind of thing on some things, especially on the low ones. I don't know that we ever just doubled to two, but, you know, even if you added an extra 5 or something like that, we still got burned on not being able to sell them.
So in the case of Aquaman, let's take this just a step further. So maybe you don't have the capital to buy the 40, but if you adjust your orders and maybe you drop one of your Marvel 1 in 50 variants and you drop, because you maybe only sell 6 of that title, and you go from selling, getting the 50 and the variant, selling that variant for a small profit to cover the cost of those extra issues, shipping, plus maybe $10 extra.
Mm-hmm.
Are you in a better position? I would say no. Are you in a better position to do that and not capitalize the potential of Aquaman that's a returnable, fully returnable book? Or are you better off saying, you know what, this is a relaunch, it's a fully returnable title, I could catch new people that will be continuous spenders, not that one-time flash-in-the-pan sale, plus if I have a glut at the end, I can ship it back and get a credit on my DC order.
Well,
which way do you go? I would lean with the Aquaman-type approach. In most cases. Most cases.
I would too, but
it's titled and character dependent.
But option two there is if you're ordering, 1 in 50 variants each time for like the whole story arc. I mean, you've got tons of stuff you can move on eBay too if it's, but if you've got 50 of them, you're probably never going to get rid of all of them. But
yeah.
I mean, I'm thinking it's more of a one-off thing.
Without going into too much little minutia, because then it's just sort of like picking away at little things, I think we could, I know a lot of stores that order very tight on, or that ordered very tight, specifically ordered very tight on Rebirth, but at the same time there's a $200 Batman statue that they ordered from the same preview.
Sure.
And that's sitting at,
sure.
it's, it's diversification that we talked about, but at the same time, if you are a struggling comic book store, yeah, you're going to save spending $135 to get this $200 Batman. If it sells, you know, I mean, look what I'm making, but that's a lot of upfront capital that you could have gotten you a lot of those Rebirth books.
And it could take years to sell that.
Right. And like you said, you could sell it on eBay if you want.
Eventually, but then you just sell it for like cost or a little bit over.
Exactly. Right, so you're
plus the risk of shipping and damaging.
So I think a lot of places need to, you know, are you, your Eagle Moss lead figures, there's a market for them, mm-hmm. but do you need, if you're on a fixed income as a store owner, do you need to, or manager, whatever you are,
get everyone every month?
Exactly. If you're ordering Eagle Moss figures to the detriment of the comics that people are looking for, do you need to do something different?
Yeah, if you have a person that's coming in buying them, order them.
Right.
But are you better putting a lower dollar, higher count of product on your shelf that people could catch and mm-hmm. get on monthly versus that big dollar? Yeah, exactly. That's exactly
what I guess it depends on what you want them to be buying kind of thing. Because, I mean, again, Eagle Moss, this is very specific again. But I always felt those sold really well because someone could come pick up a Captain America for their dad for Father's Day or a Superman or a Supergirl for their daughter for doing good in soccer or whatever. They'll never buy a comic in their whole life. But these little things were just the impulse buys that non-comic book people would buy. So
is it just as easy to sell them on a Marvel Select Captain America, though?
Oh, those are so ugly looking.
You think so?
But that's kind of minutiae-y because basically you're saying something that's going to sit or something that...
Right.
Yeah. And it's... Yeah. Well, so, I was just going to say, do you want to add more to that topic?
So,
Let's note, by the way, that Chris did dress up for this.
He did. He looks audio very only. Spiffy.
Oh, he's even got a Superman shirt under his nice Eddie Bauer fleece.
Want to see my undies? Wait. No. How many I don't even know if you can answer that. How many new subscribers did you actually get and retain from Rebirth? Do you think?
From Rebirth?
Yes.
I don't know if Rebirth created many new subscribers. I think what Rebirth did was adjust existing lists.
Definitely adjusted pull lists.
I'd say we got, probably 10. 15 would be way pushing it. But maybe I would say 10 would be a good number that Rebirth caused as far as new subscribers go. But the thing is, we haven't retained all of those people. There's some mm-hmm. of those people that have canceled their books already. Interestingly enough, we got one guy who we had one guy who came in because of Rebirth, and he started a pull list for one book, and then he would come and pick him up on Thursdays when we would have D&D. And then he's like, what are they doing? And he started coming in for D&D.
Yeah,
and now he's here for D&D all the time and spends way more money on D&D than he ever did on comic books. So it's like
Rebirth, that's why you diversify.
Right. So Rebirth didn't create a big comic spender for us. But it
brought a customer.
Exactly.
A repeat customer. Okay. And I will say that there were some people that were very heavy on Marvel titles. I don't know an exact number, but for the limited amount of time that I'm in the store doing things, I have experienced some customers peeling back on their Marvel books or even their Image books and picking up some DC books because the lower price point, the frequency, mm-hmm. things like that. So that did happen a little bit too, some shifting in where dollars are spent.
So, but you go back to saying, is it better to have 50 books that people come in that you can retain? My question is, was it really? I mean, good that I think you did it the right way. I mean, obviously it worked. But
if they're not there, you have no chance. That's
true,
thing.
But would they have come? Yeah, that's true.
Well, and there's a big that's diminishing true. Returns on Rebirth.
If they come in
stuff.
And they're disappointed, you don't even get those 10.
Exactly.
If Batman Beyond number one had come out the first week of Rebirth, or the second week, or the third week, I think we would have sold through all of them. As it stands, we've got a ton of Batman Beyond. Well, we've got not as much as we had a couple weeks ago, but we've got a good amount of Batman Beyond number one sitting on the shelf because I think the Rebirth number one effect has worn off.
Terry McGinnis. This is good Batman Beyond. Mm-hmm. This is a good run right now, from my opinion.
Good covers.
Great
looks
covers.
Good. But it just...
Good variant covers.
But the sheen is off. It's not...
It's not new and flashy because
right. It's
been 6 months or five mm-hmm. months or whatever. Yeah.
It's so sad that it only takes that long. I think that's what you're running up against. It's like consumer fickleness a little bit. But...
Oh, for sure.
So I think...
And remember, weekly comics isn't by any stretch of the imagination, or even twice monthly is not a new thing at all. I mean, there's a reason that you're your detective and your action and your books in the 40s were at, you know, issue 123 by the mid 40s. There were a lot of weekly books that were coming out back then. Yeah. There were weekly books in the 80s. DC was doing Action Weekly. They even had, you know, like when they had Green Lantern in the title and stuff like that.
But those are generally short little runs of weekly stuff, right? I mean, they only ran it for not that long.
I thought Action was weekly didn't it go weekly for a couple of years?
Well, I don't know.
Amazing Marvel did, when, I think it was right when Dan Slott started and they stole Steve Wacker from, DC when 52 was coming out. And Amazing Spider-Man was three times a month. There wasn't weekly, but it was three times a month. And that, they sold tons of copies of that.
Yeah.
So I think that it's not a new thing what DC's doing.
By no stretch, no. I think the volume, the scale of it,
mm-hmm.
is something that hasn't been seen across their line.
Right.
But individual titles have definitely done it in the weekly books. I mean, we had the Batman Eternal, all that stuff. So before we transition to a slightly different topic, we talked about some of the metrics, some of the practices that publishers do that make the market healthy or unhealthy or can cause health or, you know, the downfall of stores. Let's do it. Is our store healthy? Let's talk about it a little bit.
Okay.
So we looked at our numbers year over year. And?
It looks healthy to me.
We're not closing.
Well, unless there's a comet or another fire or
So what I know about your numbers compared to where our numbers were, you're fine.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in this area. Because after 2 years, I would have expected to see a little bit of honeymoon phase wear off kind of thing and numbers to drop, but it doesn't sound like that's occurring.
But well, and you never know. We might plateau this year. You can only hit so much growth.
No, you're right. But so when we did our initial analysis 10 years ago, I mean, you guys have probably already exceeded what we expected this area to generate, what we could squeeze out of this area.
So you had like a ceiling that you thought you could hit?
Yeah, and it was a reasonable ceiling. I mean, it was viable, so we did it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, expanded product lines are good. I mean, the video games and the records, I don't know. But again, even if it's just getting people in, and obviously the expanded gaming stuff is a great idea. So whatever, and expanded hours I think are really good. Better staff.
I think another thing that's actually helped us in dribs and drabs, which has turned into bigger things, is our online social media presence and how we handle some of our sales avenues, ventures, whatever you want to call them, through that. I mean, we started using some Facebook groups that sell comics to put some of our sets on, which have now turned into long distance subscribers, you know,
right,
thousands of miles away, who subscribe to us because they trust us, because they have transparency into our store. So I think it's those things too. But one thing's for sure, in my opinion, I feel like over the last couple of years, we've seen subscribers come, we've seen subscribers go,
mm-hmm.
we've cried when some subscribers left and cheered when, you know, when some of those boxes that never got emptied, you know, we finally just pulled a cord. But I think more than anything, the environment and the customers that we've had coming in have brought a lot of energy to the store. And I think that that's helped.
Oh, absolutely.
The Games Workshop people, the growth of Dungeons & Dragons going from, you know, a handful of what you would expect to see for D&D to all of a sudden a group of high school girls wanting their own event options so that they can have their own time too. Mm-hmm. I mean, just things like that. I know you guys did a ton of stuff, Chris, when you owned the store with the community, doing art outreach and literacy type things, and seeing those kids coming back and now they're in junior high or high school or beyond and saying, gosh, I remember coming in here for this or that. And now you've got all this extra stuff. So it's just been fun to watch the growth.
Well, and back issues. They're
back issues.
Oh, that's another thing.
That's a cool thing is when we get somebody who's like, yeah, I drove over from Iowa. I'm going to look over your back issues for the day.
And you solved the back issue problem, right? Because I don't know where you get your collections. I mean, I swear to God, once
we
sold
that door.
I know. But we've always been open to buy collections, but we never saw anything like what you've been seeing.
But because I was buying them before.
Yeah.
So it's like there are different avenues to
that's your niche, and that is an awesome thing, and it's not offered anywhere else.
And hitting the local conventions as best as we can.
Mm-hmm. We got our single, several of our best customers have come from shows who have never heard of us. So
another avenue we never took. And you solved the back issue problem, right? Because when we started, we had okay set of back issues, but after a while, it just dried up. I mean, if you can't get them, you can't sell them. Mm-hmm. So whatever you're doing, finding the great back issues is actually really successful.
That some of your back issues that you guys would get the good stuff in wouldn't stay in the store. So that's always
that
an issue that you
true.
Have to, that you have to, you have to overcome that, you know, and not take the good stuff home.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
Long story short, as far as we're sitting as a store, we're confident, we're comfortable, we're continuing to grow. The whole reason that we did that shop crawl was to get ideas of things that we can change in the store.
We had
my brother-in-law who doesn't live in the state, who's been in the shop less than 5 times, I think, come in, take a look, and then we took him with and asked him, okay, based on these other stores you've seen, what are things we can do different? What are things we can do better? And he really didn't have a lot of things that he could point to, which was validating in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the things he pointed out were really, I think, valuable. So we're going to work on those things. We've expanded in the last 2 weeks. You know, board games have, doubled in the amount we're carrying? Games Workshop is probably doubled.
Games Workshop's more than doubled. Well,
and your board game selection is a good thing, right? Because other stores in the area are downsizing their board games. I would say fairly dramatically. So,
and we got the big thing that we did with, I went through and I kind of collated a list off of like Board Game Geek.
Yeah,
and,
like the top 10s.
The stuff that, I went deeper than that, you know, it was like the top 50, and I went through, and there's stuff that you're never ever going to sell out of a store on those lists.
Right.
There's stuff that's out of, plenty of stuff that's out of print. So if it's some game from 1989 that we'd love to probably get a copy in here, but we can't just order from a distributor. So we, don't have that. Fireball Island? Well, I've got it in my living room. So we've got, if you walk in and you look at our board games right now, and it's going to change
weekly
to week, but we've got like the top, 30 rated board games that are available to order. And then you've got your staples, Scrabble and Clue and Monopoly and things like that. And you have your $15 Connect Four, but then you've got $120 Conan Monolith board game. And you have to have
it's diverse
all the ends of the spectrum.
Yep.
But even that can get a little
pricey.
It can get very pricey, but it can also get to the point of saturation too, because like Star Wars is X-Wing, and everybody knows what X-Wing is.
Mm-hmm.
X-Wing is just the ships that are all like to scale with X-Wings and TIE Fighters and the Millennium Falcon. But you can't get, if you wanted to have a Star Destroyer in X-Wing scale, it would be like 10 feet long. So you can't really do that. So now they have Star Wars Armada, which is another mini Star Wars miniature game, also by Fantasy Flight. And it's bigger ships, but it's a different scale, right? And then they have the kind of the Warhammer scale. They have Imperial Assault, also by Fantasy Flight, which is like character-based Star Wars game. So I wonder at some point, I mean, it's hard to decide if you're a store, what are we going to carry? Are we going to carry the full line of Imperial Assault, X-Wing, and Armada? We've never had anybody ask for Armada. We've had people look for X-Wing. We've had people look for Imperial Assault. But X-Wing by far is the main, the big one. But
must be a way you can sort of research what's sort of hot and what people are looking for.
And we did.
eBay sales or whatever. But even then, that could last for 4 months and then.
Yeah, and it's certainly, it's not going to be geographic.
True.
And so that's another thing if you're a store that it's great to have a big line of stuff, but you don't have to go hog wild and piss away, a grand to bring in the full Armada line,
right?
Only to find out that 9 months later, Armada's discontinued,
So one of the things we did was people would come and ask if we have it. We could special order for them. And if they stayed around or whatever, we can continue to order. If they started a small game, we'd continue to carry them. Because then we knew we had a customer base. But again, it goes back to the 50 comics on the shelf, right? If they come in and don't have it, is a special order going to do it for them?
I remember there was a customer that kept saying that Games Workshop would be good.
Yeah, but he knew what he was talking about.
Uh-oh.
So, do we think that kind of wraps up the store-type discussion and move on to our other main topic?
Yeah, I think the other topic definitely ties into it, though.
So, the second part of the discussion, do you want to lead us off?
Yeah, so the other, the big thing, and there's going to be more and more of this coming out, I think, and then, well, throughout 2017, a lot of convention closing. So we have thought for a long time that the comic convention, pop culture convention scene was totally oversaturated, horribly, horribly so. And you're starting to see a lot of stuff happen where, you know, Wizard got rid of a lot of their shows. They cut back, Madison's gone, you know, that was the closest one to us. They cut back a lot of shows, and now it sounds like Wizard is in
financial
pretty dire financial straits right now.
Again.
But they have been before, but it wasn't really tied into a period of time like this where you're seeing a lot of other cons fail. That there was a Geek Expo that was that Stan Lee one?
Yeah.
Where they just had a lot of issues where they...
With talent?
With what?
With talent?
Well, they had... I think the credit card that they had attached to all the guest hotel wasn't...
defaulted, and so the guests didn't have a place to stay. They didn't get paid.
The hotels locked them out of their rooms and things like that. And there's not... We saw it here with... it was 2 years ago where they had... It was Awesome Con or something like that they tried to do in Milwaukee. It was a big thing, and they canceled it before the con even happened because they'd had another show in another state that was so bad, they were like already out like $40,000 on their deposits and stuff like that. They said, you know what, we're just going to eat this. I'm wondering if, and a lot of people are wondering, is this the year that we start seeing massive consolidations of conventions? And
to further that question, is that a bad thing?
I don't think so. I think it's a great thing. Yeah.
Here's the thing. I mean, so how many, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, Wizards started their expansion into every mid-market they could think of?
What? Did they start longer ago than that?
I don't think so.
Madison was 2 years ago, but I think they were steadily cranking up.
Right. Wherever there was a remotely successful regional con that wasn't theirs, they started to ramp up. I mean, their contraction might be just them going back to what the market can handle. They sent out their feelers as far as they could, say, we're just going to keep on doing stuff until it doesn't work anymore. And that's where you know the market can handle it. So,
the
contraction's probably totally normal.
Yeah, but it's more than just that. We're seeing the contractions in other convention groups are pulling out of certain cities and reducing the amount of stars, entertainers that they have coming to their show.
I think that's probably not a bad thing.
I think that's a good thing too.
Yeah, that's a great thing.
The question is there a correlation between a large amount of conventions that are not just Wizard conventions, downsizing in 2017, does that correlate to this expectation of store closing in 2017?
So I don't think the Wizards ones does, right? Because I think they intentionally tested where the market was.
Mm-hmm.
And
they've got other crap going on. They've got these lawsuits against the Shamuses, and apparently they're...
The Killer Whales?
Not the Shamus.
I think they're Shamus. Sorry.
But they've got... plenty of dirty laundry. I think that besides pushing too hard out,
they've got some employee issues.
So I think all the local cons, for the most part, in my experience, in my whole life kind of thing, are kind of all sort of fly by night. You'll have one that stays around for a while and then just disappears altogether.
And then another one will replace it.
Except for Milwaukee's longest running comic book convention, Burnham Bowl. Which we are at every show.
That's a seller's convention, though.
It's totally seller's convention.
It's an awesome place to go, though. But it's...
Just don't have your wedding there. We've been in to set up for shows there too many times after a wedding.
Stuff on the floor?
Anyway.
And then the other thing with Wizard leaving and vacating areas, it might open up for a smaller fish to throw back in again.
It could. Madison's a good example of that.
I would say Madison's the perfect example of that. Because maybe it's not like Wizard expects to make 10x dollars, but normal human being might expect to make 1x or 2x dollars off a convention. So a smaller person might come in and say, this is worth the effort.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you're seeing, in from what I'm viewing, you're seeing the contraction in conventions around the entertainment side of things, not the comic side of things. You know, you look at a C2E2, which is heavily focused on creators, and you're not seeing a contraction there. Heroes Con, heavily focused on creators and comic books, not seeing a contraction there. It's the places where
Emerald City Con.
These companies are, Emerald City. It's these places where companies are pumping out tens of thousands of dollars to get, you know, the cast of Boondock Saints to come in and to get the cast of Full House.
But even C2E2 is guilty of that. They had that whole, last year they've got that whole wrestler section that I remember when C2E2 came on the scene, the big thing that people were saying C2E2 was going to save them from was having to go to the Wizards wrestling show in Chicago. You know, basically saying the Wizard World Chicago had denigrated into a bunch of wrestlers, and like, you know, you go to see the wrestler section, and then over here is Miss Cleo, and then the guy, she's dead.
Oh, poor lady.
So she won't be at any shows coming up. But now, I mean, eventually if you're a show that's not New York or San Diego, do they all end up, like, you might start out with good intentions. We want to be this creator-driven show and not do this. But do they all end up becoming that Wizard World model once they hit a certain amount of business? Like where they say, you know, we can get this many more people in and this many more dollars if we have these wrestlers over here in this section.
So I think the other thing, the tiredness with the convention, is a lot of them are so formulaic right now. You go see all the Buffy stars that aren't, you know, that you had crushes on or whatever when you were a teenager. And they're the same people at every show.
Yeah.
And you know, after a while, it's like, all right, I've seen them once, seen them twice, so it's kind of cool.
And not just that they were at 20 shows. You saw, you know, they were at 20 shows this year. You went to 3 of them. They were at those 20 shows for the last 10 years.
Right. So everyone's had the opportunity to get to who they want to get to. And now, you know, it's expensive. The other thing I think is sort of sad is that San Diego is so hard to get into. I mean, good for them, but I don't even think about bothering to go anymore. I just assume that any wizard convention is going to be difficult to get into or too expensive to make it worthwhile. Like, it was great when you were a kid and you can pay $5 and you got to see Howard Chaykin and Walter Simonson.
I love when before it was Wizard World, when I went to Chicago, I met Julius Schwartz and
you didn't pay an arm and a leg for it.
No.
I mean, it was... So,
well, I got in for free when I was a young lad, but
snuck in,
you know.
No,
yeah, I ran out of the house and ran down to Chicago.
So, I mean, I think price point on conventions is another problem, and what you're getting from that price point.
Yeah, and I
bigly,
and the other thing too is you used to go to shows to find issues you couldn't find or at decent prices or whatever, but since it's so expensive for retailers to get into the big shows, there's no point in going there to look for stuff.
Well, we talked about this kind of extensively in the Wizard World Chicago one we did. That was probably the most negative recording we've ever done.
Yeah.
Sadly, but
way more negative than our talk about Marvel.
Well, with shows, if it's going to cost you, you've got your upfront costs where you've got to book yourself the spot, you've got to get a table, or you got to get a hotel. You probably, if you're a bigger dealer, you're going to have more than one person,
room,
right?
Yeah.
You have to, otherwise how are you going to go to the bathroom?
Or you're going to have to get the convention yourself.
If you don't have a truck, you're probably going to have to get a truck. Yeah. And that's going to be, you know, $400 round trip for the weekend. And so most of these people are going to be in, you know, $3,000, maybe $3,500 before,
and that's if
before
you just
even started.
That's just if you have one block. If you're getting two or three, your cost is exponential.
Now, I remember when Mile High, what's his face from Mile High? Chuck Rosansky?
Yeah.
When he had said, he had gotten really mad and written a big, long article talking about how he wasn't going to do San Diego anymore. Because for the first year ever, I think he hadn't been profitable or something like that. And I remember reading that his booth was like $50,000. And he said, the problem is everybody goes to San Diego, And the people used to come and buy comic books, but now they stand in line to get the new Funko Pop or whatever. I think that was before Funko Pops, but
whatever. It rings true. The convention true. Variant.
Right. And he says, that money's not coming to us anymore. Now, I thought they were there. Was Mile High there?
Yeah. They were on the end wall.
Okay.
Right?
So obviously he's changed his tune about that and come back. But if the other thing that's happened with shows and with high-end comics where you used to go and you buy, I really want to get this giant size X-Men number one, so I'm going to go to the comic show and buy it. But comics have transitioned into being in such investment opportunities for people that aren't comic collectors.
Yeah.
They're told to diversify their portfolio, and you should buy some comics. So they, you know, some of these guys, well, it'd be fun. We'll go to a show. I'll bring 10 grand, and they'll buy a 9-2 Hulk 181. And so the price is driven up on all of that stuff. And people know that if you're a dealer, and you should be able to. If you're a dealer, you should be able to ask more for the irons. Exactly, exactly. If you can, you know somebody will pay you 8 grand for this book. Why wouldn't you take it, no matter who's buying it? But there's a lot less opportunities to. You used to go to Wizard World Chicago, and there would be hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of, you know, 4 for $1, 2 for $1 bins and stuff like that.
I remember one year, one guy. It had to be Wizard World Chicago. It just had like a big cardboard box. I mean, giant. 2 refrigerator box sized box on a pallet with just comics and magazines chucked in there. And they were like 25 cents each. Just dig through. I'm like, yeah, that's what we're looking for in conventions.
Well, and that's part of it too, is that those places they're not fiscally able to swing it because of the investment that they have in it and the quality of merchandise that they want to sell is they're trying to target people who just want to get those issues just to read and enjoy it. They're not necessarily looking at selling the investment side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're going to be out 3-4 grand, that means they got to sell. In most cases, they're not selling less than $1 anymore just because of inflation and the cost.
Oh, totally.
They got to sell $3,000 to $4,000 just to break even.
Of what used to be those, or the average booth that used to be those 2 for $1 books or whatever, they're now $2 books. You get a lot of those dealers that have, they're bagged and boarded. The presentation is there.
It's beautiful.
But they're $2 books, mm-hmm. and that's what you used to go and get for 2 for $1 or even 4 for $1. But now they're bagged and they're boarded and they're alphabetized and they're numerical in the alphabetization, and so they're charging $2 for it, you know?
Because they've got time into it. And
exactly.
Time is money.
Exactly.
And, you know, I think running the shop is one of those things where it's a double-edged sword, right? Because we get to experience it from both sides. Because as a buyer, you buy the stuff you want. As a retailer, you have to deal with shenanigans, and you get excited when those big collections come in and you do all that. But then you go to a convention, and it's like, oh, shoot, you know what? I wanted to see if I could find this random issue of Batman from the 90s.
Price so high.
Yeah, and you get there, and you're like, that should be $1. $2.50. And you're like, well, we don't have the book, or I don't have the wherewithal to go through their 40 long boxes of dollar books and find it. But I'm still not paying it because it's like, you know what? Fine. I'll find it someday here. And you kind of disenfranchise yourself from it. But you do. You walk around and you're like, why would people come here and pay double or triple the amount when we've got those by the bushel basket, you know?
I also think, too, it used to be that having dealers at your show was beneficial to the show. So they didn't feel like, And gouge is the wrong word. It's not, but that's the word I'm going to use. They didn't feel the need to gouge the dealers to have a table because they wanted people there. They needed something for the guys who are paying $5 at a door to do and see and sort through.
But now it's $95 at the door.
Yeah.
For the weekend or whatever.
So they're making a killing and they're still getting it on the retailer end also, which, you know, to me that's more of an asset. That's what you're presenting to your customer as opposed to having the dealers be their customer.
So we had somebody who told us that, and we completely agreed with it. They said, well, yeah, man, I don't know why you don't get free tables at shows for the same reason. And I said, well, I mean, we would like that, but it's never going to happen.
Paying, even if you're paying like the $5 per table that the venue charges
cover the cost.
Cover the cost. That's $20. Fine.
Yeah. Right. And yeah, believe me, we don't need the chair because we don't sit.
No. So
keep the chair in your closet.
No. And we'll have one person with us that'll sit after he goes out and buys 10 Little Caesars pizzas.
Tom?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Hi, Tom.
He did that last time. He went out. We were at Serb Hall, and he went out, and he said he was going to get pizza. He came back, and he had, like, 8 pizzas. You said, there's 4 of us, Tom. He's like, well, I wasn't sure.
I didn't know what everybody wanted.
Thanks, Tom.
We love you, Tom. You're the best.
So So we ended up having, we had like, we set up four table, or all like all the chairs behind the tables with like pepperoni.
And you started selling pizza by the
cheese,
slice.
I was going to say sausage. That's what you should have done. Well, he did. We told him to go around and do it, and he got, he traded some pizza for comics. But yeah, back on topic. So you're Mr. Optimist then, and you think that really the, we don't, I mean, I guess we kind of really don't have a view on it either way, pessimistic or optimistic, which is why we do the show. But you think that it's, if it happens and there's a bunch of closings, be it conventions or stores, that it is the market kind of deciding what should be there.
It's a market correction.
It's a market correction. I don't think the market's going to go away. I don't think comics are just going to go away suddenly. Even if they contract a bunch, they're still going to exist. The problem comics have is inherent in what it is. It's a serialized thing, right?
Right.
And honestly, for, what is it, 50 years for Marvel? That they've been going with one character, and that's a lot of stories to come up with that are new and fresh for everybody for a long time. Like soap operas started a little bit before that, now they're dying out completely on TV just because we've had one too many comas or whatever.
Sure.
And comics has that same problem.
If only they would make like an all new, all different Spider-Man.
Oh, wait.
Now.
Like.
Oh, wait.
Like the Muslim Spider-Man. We don't have one of those yet.
Or
do we want to dip into that part of the discussion?
Oh, let's go way off topic.
Because I mean, that is a relevant.
I do like what topic. Marvel's doing, even though it's kind of contrived with Ms. Marvel, and even the She-Hulk comic, I think, is kind of clever, just calling it Hulk. I think those are all good ideas.
But the question that I would throw on that is: do you continue to dilute your brand and your character when you have the Almighty Thor, the Unworthy Thor? You've taken away. So when kids go and see a movie today, right? Like they go to see the MCU, and they're going to go see Captain America. They see Steve Rogers.
Mm-hmm.
They come to the store and they ask for the Captain America book. Most shops are going to take them, and they're not going to get a Steve Rogers book unless if the shop knows, do you want Steve Rogers or do you want
the Falcon.
So you've got to make sure you do that. And I feel like while I totally understand why Marvel's trying to do it, they're trying to show what America is now. We are a diverse population. There are many facets to us. Are they doing it the right way?
But again, I don't think, and my opinion on it is not that,
or does it even
not
matter?
To give them, I don't think it's, I think people give them credit for diversifying, but I think it's for the wrong reasons. I think
they're clearly diversifying to get market share.
Well, to get market share, but I think
but
more than, well, here's the big thing. Remember what, we keep talking about Marvel, but it's Disney that we should be saying, really, right? So now if you have Disney doesn't care if Marvel sells 80,000 copies of a book or 70,000 copies of the book, right? Because they're going to put out Avengers Infinity War, and it's going to make $1 billion. So they don't really care about that. So what Marvel, or what Disney is looking at Marvel as, and I'm wondering if this is coming down from, you know, the top dogs, where they're saying, we're viewing you as creators of intellectual properties. And so we want to be able to turn this into a TV show. Yeah. We want to be able to turn it into a movie, whatever it is, an animated web series. So now,
just throw it
give
up.
Us, give us
so now
this,
we need Miles Morales as Spider-Man.
Right.
Just throw it up onto the wall and see what sticks kind of thing.
Which, yeah, but it's well, not, again.
I think what James is trying to say is that Disney is saying, provide us with intellectual property that is diverse that we can then put on the screen to help us get, yeah.
Because
whether
because
it's
you
right
have,
or wrong, I guess.
You have people approaching, I'm trying to take this third approach to it because you have people that are approaching it saying, take your hands off of my characters. I don't want I don't want the Falcon as Captain America.
Right.
I don't want Invincible Iron Man that's Riri Williams or whatever the character
is. Back in my day, Spider-Man was a boy who was a young teenager.
I think actually Miles Morales is really good character.
Probably one of the best Spider-Man books.
It's cool because he's a character that came out of Bendis's run on Spider-Man and it was totally organic. And then he was the one thing they wanted to keep from one of the few things I wanted to keep from the Ultimates universe. And he worked out. He worked out well. I don't think that was them diversifying. I think a lot of the other ones, though, are the people that look at it from the other side saying that it's great what Marvel's doing and they're diversifying and they're giving these different groups a time to shine. They're giving him a hero to identify with. And I think that they're giving Marvel too much credit. And I think that it's more corporatized than anything else. And it's intellectual property driven.
So, I think you're right. And I still think it's a good thing. But I totally think you're right. It's corporate driven.
Mm-hmm.
But
so it's a good thing. That's true. It's corporate driven. That's true. The question that I think either gets skirted around or people don't want to answer, and I'm not saying that we have the right answer or even have an answer for it, is it the correct way to do it by taking existing characters and completely flipping them, or would Marvel be better served trying to put more effort into creating new, exciting characters and pushing it that way?
Like Mosaic? How's that working out for Marvel?
Yeah.
Whereas Invincible Iron Maiden Lady is working out fairly well, I would think.
Well, we just had a couple girls in yesterday that were, they had to have been like freshmen or something like that, because they were in here during the day, so they were either in high school and skipping school, or they were in college and back here. They were looking at the Marvel books, and it was weird hearing these girls talking about one of them was talking about, why did they make Thor a woman? Thor's not a woman. And I thought, it's interesting that, you know, these are some people whose really their only exposure to these characters are through the movies.
Mm-hmm. Or the media.
They've never read comics. And I asked them, you know, and they were just giggling the whole time. And I was asking them if they needed help. They're like, oh, no, we're good. And I was like, all right. But I was listening because it was interesting to hear they would look at these books and look at the covers and like comment on it. And these are they're commenting on characters that these books are supposed to, they're the people the books are supposed to appeal to.
They're the target.
Right. And they're, right, and they were saying, like, why is this
that way?
Yeah.
Thor's not a great example of that, though, because Thor being a woman, fine, I'm glad it worked out.
Mm-hmm.
Makes no sense, because mythologically Thor is a boy kind of thing. Why didn't they take Lady Sif and just make her the main character of the book or something? Something that was already existing, but, I mean,
sure.
But the thing is, they're looking at new demographics. That's the key, right?
Right.
I mean, just like you, when you expanded into Warhammer, you're like, we don't have this. These are people who aren't coming to the store. If we can get them in here, we'll get mm-hmm. some income from them. So if they can chip away slowly, even if they get like 2% of the high school girl or young college woman income, they're increasing the amount of money.
It's a long-term strategy, though.
And you're right. They are, yeah, because right now, there are minor characters that might not right. be well developed, but in 5 years, who knows?
But the Falcon is still the Falcon, right? When he's not Captain America, he's going to be the Falcon. So Sam Wilson Captain America, when that book is inevitably not going anymore, it's not the failure of a black Captain America. It's just that they took the Falcon, who was an existing character,
and made him
Captain America.
Well, my only problem with that one, and again, this is going way PC, is that in order to make the Falcon a worthwhile character, the black character more worthwhile, they had to give him the mantle of Captain America. It can read like that as opposed to just it doesn't matter who he is, he's worthy of the mantle kind of thing. But they could have just put him as the Falcon and had his run as a Falcon and had him as his own character without having to rely on the crutch of being Captain America.
So let's,
which is where my problem with that book came in.
Let me go back
to
Thor.
The art is really beautiful, though.
The art is really... Let me go back to Thor. And what you said, James, was the girl saying, this isn't Thor. You know, their expectation is that Thor is Chris Hemsworth.
Cute,
you know,
and hunky.
This yeah. bulky, you know, masculine guy, awesome-looking, you know, great actor.
Oh, and by the way, let me just tell you what they bought, just so you understand. They bought a couple of pins, so impulse buy pins. One of the girls bought a Games Workshop Citadel paintbrush and some Citadel paints, not to paint Games Workshop stuff. Just to paint. Another one bought back issues. She grabbed random Superman back issues, like Dan Jurgens early 90s Superman back issues out of the bins, and Pokemon cards. So look at all of these stuff that we just, you know, like those three girls that came in that had probably never been in here before, never been in a comic shop. They came in and they bought like four or five different categories worth of stuff.
Right.
And that, so just to go back to what we were saying before, I mean, that is fantastic.
So let's go back to Thor.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to hit on what both of you said and pose another question. So James, you were talking about their expectation being a male Thor. You were saying this is a good thing, diversifying and showing the different sides of the world. Now, you also made the comment of Thor being a woman versus a man from just a mythological sense and all of that. My question is, is it a detriment to the Thor brand by making your main Thor book a female, where you now have a secondary Thor book who is what we expect to be Thor and is shipping less than what the main title is? Would you have been better served doing something like you said, using a female more in the mythological sense as a Thor companionship type thing and having that be the secondary book? Again, I don't know if it's right or wrong. I'm just posing the question. That way your Thor brand stays strong. The people that come in and expect to see Thor, see Thor. You don't rebrand, you don't renumber, you don't lose subscribers,
except,
you know, all of those things.
Thor's got a history of that hammer changing hands, right? Because you've got mm-hmm. Beta Ray Bill, you've got
sure.
the frog.
The Thor frog.
Yeah. You've got, I think there was another one in there too.
So basically anything Walt Simonson did.
Yeah. So
he still did the best.
But again, the danger of having, you know, a female Thor as the secondary book is you're saying she's not worthy of her own book and therefore you're going to open yourself to criticism that way.
That's true.
So I don't, I guess it does, I don't think it dilutes the Thor brand per se. Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's fine. It was just a question that's worth answering.
The problem with dilution in all the comics, I think, is just by the nature of running for 50 years, it's going to be
sure.
pretty strong no matter what. Which is why sometimes the European version of, like, the graphic novel way, you know, you write one graphic novel story and then, you know, volume two, volume three kind of thing. But then someone else can come along and do a totally different take. Like mm-hmm. The Elseworlds are some of my favorite books.
So, yeah, there's some great ones.
As long as you could find a way to codify it so it's not completely confusing to someone new coming in, or even, I had to look up where the X-Men books split the other day. Like where X-Men became uncanny, you couldn't remember that.
Then, extraordinary.
And then regular X-Men, like how many times did that split? It went New X-Men, then it went Legacy, then it went back to New X-Men, then it went to Legacy. I don't even remember.
Yeah.
So well, that's the kind of stuff that drives me nuts.
To address what you said about Thor, and I guess this is the third mention now of like early 90s DC, but when you had the death of Superman and they didn't renumber, it was an action, it was an adventure, Man of Steel and the regular Superman title. You had how long with, and of course Superman came back, but how long when Superman wasn't in the book and it was Superboy, it was Steel, John Henry Irons, a new black character that they introduced. You had the Eradicator and you had Cyborg Superman. You had four characters that were introduced after Superman died, all of which at least Steel and Superboy ended up sustaining pretty long running series. Superboy more so than Steel did, but, those were all done in the core books. They kept the original numbering and they made it an event, but it didn't feel like it was just checking boxes and we're going to do this. We're going to have a,
it made sense for where it was going.
Exactly. Steel's an awesome character. Shaq aside, Steel is a great character. I love the early 90s Superboy because he appealed to somebody my age. So that was, I guess that's a case of pandering, but it worked.
Yeah.
I wonder if they would have had, just done all this and kept it going in the main Thor book and not really, and not done the big relaunch. I mean, could you have been working this whole unworthy Thor thing?
Yes, exactly.
In two?
That's exactly where I was kind of leading to.
Here's another great thing that they're not doing anymore. Is that you have your main story and then you've got your 4 to 6 page backup story, which would have been a great place for unworthy Thor. You know, instead of a 5-issue miniseries or whatever it's going to be, it could stretch out over the whole year.
Exactly. Yeah, that
would
be fantastic.
Awesome.
And just call it your core.
And it's all written by the same person.
Not to be confused with the Thor core that came out
so many wonderful years ago.
So now on the flip side, we're talking a lot of Marvel. And you talk DC Superman. We just got off of something with DC where they made a big change like that. And for me, being a Batman reader, totally backfired.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Gordon in the mech bat suit.
I didn't even know that, but the mech bat already is, it lost me, but.
Is it weird? So, is it counterproductive? In maybe in 20 years, somebody's going to be saying,
I wish they were doing things like they were doing in the
2010s.
Yeah, because we're looking back and saying,
this is
we've used how many
used
examples
to.
Of stuff that they've done in the 90s, right? Yep. And everybody looks back in the 90s. We're talking about, is the comic market where it was in the 90s?
90s variant covers.
So maybe maybe all of my examples are terrible. And maybe...
You're terrible.
Maybe I am. But maybe we're going to be looking back 20 years from now and saying, man, Marvel had their you-know-what together right now. And we just didn't know it. I don't know. Maybe that was just a thought that popped into my head. But
well, and that's the thing with comics too, is that we are creatures of habit, right? We like things a certain way, and when
and
things
Chris
change,
is saying
long term
planning with is Kamala Khan going to be in a number one character 15 years from now? You know,
or not even like or even like a Moon Knight, who's I wouldn't call like an A character per se, but everyone loves him, and his mythology is rich, getting a little confusing.
Moon Knight's been around, I think, since.
But he's had difficulties sustaining runs.
Oh yeah, because
Werewolf by
Night, 32. Silver Suit. Good idea, you guys.
But he's had a hard time sustaining a title, and part of that's creative. Part of that's the marketplace and what's happening.
Moon Knight has, but at the same time, I think that I like the rule of 25 when you're talking about characters, and if a character like Moon Knight, after 25 years, has not become an A-game character, then I don't think it's really going to happen. I think you could put out is do we consider Guardians of the Galaxy to be a game? You know, I don't think comic wise, I don't think their title is anywhere where
you wouldn't know
want
it by looking
be.
In previews with how many tie-in books they have. But
yeah, look at Punisher. How Punisher, Wolverine.
Yeah,
those are characters that got
Deadpool.
Deadpool, Harley Quinn. I think Moon Knight's always going to be. Like a B-grade character, because it's been more than 25 years.
But sellable.
Yes, sellable.
Absolutely.
There's a mystique to it that people like. There's a niche for it.
But don't push your luck and put out three. Even when Bendis, at arguably the height of his popularity, and Alex Maleev were doing a Moon Knight book, even they couldn't... I mean, what did they go for? 12 issues, I think? Moon Knight's been relaunched...
And
again, many times so New Avengers.
I don't mind for some reason. I don't mind Moon Launch. Wow, Moon Knight being relaunched, because each time they relaunch him, it's sort of like a whole new concept kind of thing. So it doesn't disturb.
Yeah,
me.
That's true.
It's not
he's
like
a character that you can do that with.
Yeah. So for some reason that is fine, and like every writer says, this is my take on Moon Knight,
and that's kind of an advantage of having a character that's
a B level. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas Punisher, I get upset when they tried to say he wasn't in Vietnam. So,
yes, you do.
I'm not getting into that.
Insert rant here.
Yeah, but whatever. I think that what are the companies right now that are we've harped on Marvel. We've said DC's got a lot of strengths and some weaknesses. What companies are doing things right?
So, you know, people will point to Image a lot. And say that there's a glut of Image number ones in new series. But I will give them this more as a reader than a retailer. As a reader, the variety that they put out is second to none.
And they're not relaunching the same characters over and over again. They're getting
new
whole
series,
new concept
new
by whole new creators. So that's a little different.
Yeah. And so every retailer, save for a couple, every publisher, save for a couple, could always do more. To work with retailers to push their books, doing different things. And each retailer is going to give them five different ideas of what they would want them to do. But for me, Image is one of those where there's going to be some stinkers that come out. And then there's going to be some, you caught lightning in a bottle. And then there's going to be a lot of really good stuff that floats right in the middle. I think you look at companies like IDW, that their hardcover packages for things like their artist editions, even just their hardcovers in general, find a company that does better hardcover books. I don't know if you'll find one. They are just gorgeous. They're well put together, well bound. The papers are nice. You look at Boom. And for us, for our store, the Boom market is mostly kids. Lumberjanes, Backstagers, you know, things like that. And to have a the art style, although different, and each book still has that same tone. The colors are bright. They're very... eye-catching for young audiences, and I think that's
really
good.
It's one story per one issue kind of stuff, too. They're not, like, continuing on.
Right. I mean, they package things like Lumberjanes in a trade, but right. you can read each issue and not be lost. You know, and so I think that those are good. And then you've got Valiant that has arguably one of the biggest surprises of 2016 with Faith. And it's a book that, depending on your market, just like you were saying with those covers, may sell great in New York and California, but in the Midwest, maybe not. Mm-hmm. In the cases of Faith, depending on your market, you could sell gangbusters on it. Others, maybe not. Like, we didn't sell a ton of Faith, but Valiant, who is, as a retailer, one of the best companies out there to work with, sent us a large quantity of the Faith ongoing series, number one, to hand out for our in-store convention, and then the mm-hmm. leftovers we were able to hand out for Halloween as a way to try and get readers in. I mean, did it work? Yeah, we got a couple, but, you know, that whole idea of them promoting it was important, I thought. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess the best way to close it off would be, are they, what company is best supporting comic stores? Like, who has the model that all the other companies should follow with regard to maintaining the healthiness of the comic market? Is it DC? Is it Valiant? What do you think?
Or do they both have reasonable models? I mean, I remember we didn't do a ton of Valiant, mm-hmm. obviously, when I was here, except to Neil.
But you guys were through, like, two Valiant relaunches, really, right?
Maybe, yeah. But even the most recent... I mean, Valiant was always willing to work with a local store. Mm-hmm. And, honestly, when they did the first, you can send these back to us kind of thing, mm-hmm. and, you know, they were always willing to do stuff for us. And we could even get... Sometimes you get variants directly from them if we needed one for somebody. They were very cool about that sort of stuff. So, I mean, but sounds like DC's kind of doing the same thing for you guys now, too.
They're good. They're,
yeah. You know what I would like to see is, it'd be cool, I think I said this earlier, if they would give every store, not like a Cowabunga store variant, but just like a comic book retailer variant, every store based on sales got, you know, one or two copies.
That'd be cool.
So that, you know, you buy them for $3 or whatever, and then you can sell them for whatever they're going for. And even like posters and stuff too, like it'd be cool if they would send out just swag you could just sell for inexpensively, but still that, you know, cheap advertising to sell to the people that might generate extra income that cost you basically nothing.
Now, on the other hand,
that kind of stuff would be cool.
Well, I agree, but we spent a lot of time talking about Marvel and one of the big two companies and what they were doing wrong. But there was one company, we won't name names, that we wanted to. We don't carry any of their books,
yep.
and we thought we'll give them a shot.
We were going to dabble.
We were going to do some dabbling, and we went and talked to them, and we were saying, you know, what's it going to take? And they were exceptionally unfriendly, and
they were more than willing to tell us how to run our business,
right?
The way
right.
they wanted.
They were telling us that if we wanted to sell their books, that we would have to get a rack that would go right. On the countertop next to the register where we would have, what is it, 50 or 60 of their titles or something like that. And that,
the best way to do it was to fly in one of their executives who's also a writer.
Right.
But if we're going to do that, we'd have to pay travel expenses, per diem for food, hotel costs, and we'd have to make sure that we book at least two sessions with a local school for them to talk about literacy.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd have to have a store. I mean, it was just ridiculous.
And all we had said was we were interested
in selling your titles.
Right. And
tell us about them.
And guess what? We're not carrying them.
No.
And guess what? We haven't had anyone asking for them.
Yep.
So I don't know. I still need breakfast. But I haven't, I don't know. That's an instance where you got to have one of those companies that they've got to, I don't know why they think that they're able to tell retailers stuff like that. But
well, Games Workshop did that. A while ago, too,
did
right?
Did they really?
Yeah, they had... one of the reasons we didn't jump on 5 years ago was their package was so hard. It's like, you need to carry all of our product lines. You need to have the rack here. You need so much wall space.
Well, they have that...
And they required you to buy so much. Like, for instance, all yeah. we wanted was 40K or whatever. And mm-hmm. they you're going to have Lord of the Rings. You're going to have to carry Fantasy
Well, that
battle.
Was the that was their introductory thing. Like, you have right. to buy in their top, whatever it is, their maintain their top however many levels of...
each game. So you've got to have the top 5% of 40K fantasy in Lord of the Rings. But Lord of the Rings is pretty much done. They don't even have that on the mandatory wall anymore. And honestly, I only order fantasy when I need it, and when they try to push the new stuff on us, I just tell them I don't want it. You know, I don't want it. It doesn't sell. I get it in from time to time, but not very often.
I think they're much more casual now, and that was my point, was it?
Yeah, they've changed.
That they've changed because you can't dictate to the store owners what you want.
Right. Well, and the other thing
is, every market's different.
And if I'm putting in a $900 order for 40K stuff this week, and they're telling me, you know, what are they going to do? Are they going to try to strong arm me? Or I go, all right, don't worry about it, you know?
Right.
So I think they know not to push their luck. And I wonder if some of those smaller companies if
they back themselves into a corner by trying to be too pushy with their own desires. And, you know, there's companies that are in the back, those publishing companies are in the back half of the previews that are very small. Albatross Funny Books, right? Yay. Eric Powell. He doesn't push anything on us. We carry some of his books because we have customers that love it. We're happy to bring it in. And I think the biggest thing is there's so many books on the market now, not just big two, but across.
Yeah,
if you get previews and look at it, there's, 3,500, 4,000 items in that thing?
It's huge.
It's huge. And there's no feasible way. I don't even know if things like Midtown could buy every single thing in previews.
There's no market for a lot of
exactly right. And I'm just talking print merchandise. I'm not even talking T-shirts and Funkos and action figures and statues. I'm just talking print. And I think there are some strong points to what DC does, strong points to what Valiant does. There are even some strong points to what Marvel does. And I don't think any company has mastered what it takes to be the perfect publisher for retailers, because at the end of the day, they all have different business needs, requirements, expenses, etc.
And the other thing too, you as a retailer, it's kind of like getting to know someone. You know what to expect from Marvel now. You know what to expect from DC and Valiant. So you know what Marvel's doing. So if you don't want to partake in that, you can just order what you need to do. And it's not like they're breathing down your throat saying you must do it our way and buy every variant. They're just presenting
it's
it there
their
for you
model
to have
model.
It. Right. Yeah. And you know that. So, and you know your customers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you bring in what you know is going to sell, and that's fine.
Boom.
Them too. So, does that pretty much wrap it up for this episode?
I think so.
Let's do one extra little fun thing. So this is kind of we talked a lot about 2016 for the store, and we did well, and we're moving into 2017. So let's go around. What is one thing in the comics marketplace that you would like to see change, whether it be conventions, whether it be from a retailer standpoint or from a distributor or publisher standpoint?
Okay. Mine will be pretty easy and pretty obvious. Let's go with less relaunches.
Oh, my God. I should have gone first.
All right, that's two for less relaunches.
Keep the core books going at their numbers, because, honestly, I want my full run of Thor from 1967 or whatever on. And yeah, just if you want to throw out crap on the side, like miniseries and do it.
But Beta Ray Bill goes to town.
I'd say less relaunches would be good. And instead of hyping the number ones, just hype the new creative group that comes on.
Sure.
If you know, like, hype worthy.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously when you relaunch, you're going to put someone, or you're going to make it sound hype worthy. You know, all-star artist.
Oh, also one other one. This would make it easier for us to sell a lot of books. Less politics in comic books.
Yes.
That would be a huge one. Everybody's got a right to,
their vote. Opinion.
When you have the creator saying that they won't come to a certain state because of how that state voted, it's that kind of thing is so off-putting for readers.
And that state could have been 51% of the vote to 49, and you've now ostracized 49%. And that 49% could be the people that are buying your books. You don't know.
So I would just in general like a lot less. But if politics makes sense for the story that you're telling
in, you know, if President Luthor is going to be whatever, doing something, I know he's not president, but, if your story involves a certain degree of politics, or it's a Greg Rucka book about espionage or something, like, go ahead with it, you know, but I just would like less polarization in comics. It makes it harder to sell books. It's that simple.
Right, and it's everyone's entitled to their opinion, but it only diminishes our ability to sell it.
Mm-hmm.
And it puts us in an awkward position. You know, if you put a character on a cover, but you only put one side of the discussion on the cover and we carry that, all of a sudden we could be vilified for not supporting the other side as well. And that's not a position that, as a business owner and a retailer, in a... what can be a tight market that you want to put yourself in. So we have to make the decision to not carry that book. And that's hard.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I think the two things that I would want are from a retailer and a selfish perspective. Number one, I would just say that you, James, Sam, and myself go out of our way to make sure whoever comes into this store has an enjoyable experience. They have the help they need to find the books that they're looking for. We put so much energy and effort into that. And to go to even local stores, and I'm not just talking about us, but anyone who goes to a store that doesn't give them a good customer experience, that doesn't provide them a place where they like going to, go to a different store. Take your dollars elsewhere. People say vote with your wallet. That's true when it comes to buying books, but it's also true in what you support. If you go to a bad retail establishment, you go to a bad restaurant, you're not going back. Comic book buyers are creatures of habit. You have a pull list, you're going to keep returning there. In 2017, if you go to a bad store, find a good store if you can. That's one wish I have. And the second wish is, if you are a pull list subscriber, please pick up a previews. Even if you just come into the store and ask to look at it. Look at it, know what's coming out, because we can't play the guessing game on every single title that's coming out in previews, but we are more than happy, and we will make damn sure if you want it, we order it in for you. But we don't know if you don't tell us. So I would just say...
And sometimes they can't always get it after it comes out. They're right. Sold out, and they're just not gettable anymore.
Right.
So...
like all of you that want the 7 to Eternity first print and you missed it, we didn't have a single person come to us and say, please pre-order 7 to Eternity. Now, we did. We ordered it and sold out the first day.
Mm-hmm.
But it's things like that where we try and keep you aware of it, but with the hundreds of new things every month, we just can't do it all.
And previews is just cool to look through anyway. So.
It is.
And like I said,
good bathroom reading.
We always have a couple of extra copies, and if you can't afford the, you know, the couple of bucks to get it, by all means, just grab a table and sit down and look at our store copy. So those are my two wishes as a selfish retailer.
No, that's a good one. Previews is cool, and it's very helpful to your local comic book store. So,
well, what do you think? It's a Tuesday. It's a rainy, cold, wet, ugly Tuesday, and I think we're going to have to process some books very soon.
So. We are. So I think we will sign off. Chris, thank you for coming and sharing your thoughts and
we
time.
We hope you My will come pleasure. Back again.
Yeah, we're going to do drunk previews with Eric.
Drunk previews with Eric.
I'm down.
Does that mean I'm drunk or you guys are drunk? Or we're all drunk?
If you can run the computer drunk, you can drink too.
Yeah.
Oh, good. All right. See you next time.